From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's show, I speak with journalist and novelist Francine Duplessis Gray. Her new book, Adam and Eve and the City, is a collection of her essays from the late 60s to the 80s on politics, religion, and women. Also today, I talk with Emil Artolino, director of the new film Dirty Dancing. He's also directed many television dance programs, including many editions of the PBS Dance in America series. Rock historian Ed Ward looks at Cal-Mex music, original sound that didn't fade away with the death of Ritchie Valens. And book critic John Leonard reviews Whatever Happened to Gloomy Gus of the Chicago Bears, the new novel by Robert Coover. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. My guest, Francine Duplessis Gray, is a novelist and journalist. Or as she puts it, she's equally interested in the poetry of fact and the fact of fiction. Her new book is a collection of her magazine articles from the past 18 years on politics, religion, and women in the worlds of literature and fashion. There are also pieces about Gray's own development as a writer. The book is called Adam and Eve and the City, and it's published by Simon & Schuster. Francine Duplessis Gray grew up in France, where her father died during World War II fighting in the resistance. During the German occupation, she and her mother fled to America. Her stepfather in America was editorial director for Condé Nast Publications. Early in her career, Francine Gray wrote for a French fashion magazine. Since then, her work has been published in The New Yorker, Vogue, Vanity Fair, and The New York Times. I spoke to her earlier today from the NPR Bureau in New York. I asked if she thought there were themes that emerged in her new collection of essays that unite her work.
Yes, I think the dominant theme is memory, is a necessity of memory, both individual and historic, to enable the conscience, the individual conscience, to work at moments of critical historical moments. So that I think it is really a book about memory and how memory works and the interaction between individuals and the historical moment is how I look at the book in general.
You've alternated during your career between writing novels and reporting. And you credit poet Charles Olson, who you studied with at Black Mountain College, with teaching you that fiction isn't necessarily more creative than nonfiction is. Would that have been a hang-up for you if you hadn't come to that realization?
I think it would have been, because I think that since several decades, the literature has really been controlled by the consumer market. And the consumers like to label artists. I mean, you're either a fiction writer or a nonfiction writer. And I don't like to be labeled. I like to avoid any typification. And I think what Wilson really did for me is to teach me a piece of history and to stress always that some of the greatest works of literary art throughout all times, be it Gibbon's History of Rome or James Agee's Let Us Not Be Famous Men, were works of nonfiction, could be as great as fiction, and to destroy the distinction between the two and just look at all literature as text. And that's really what he did to me and liberated me a great deal.
You studied at Black Mountain College, which was a radical utopian school that graduated a lot of the American avant-garde. But you also studied at Bryn Mawr College, which is one of the, most important women's academic colleges. How did you end up at Black Mountain, given the background that you had?
I think I went to Black Mountain like a cow goes to the Salt Lick, in the sense that you often go towards those opposite poles of experience, which you really badly need to balance out your personality. And I had a very straight-laced European education. Then I went for 7 years as a scholarship student to a very straight-laced girls' school in New York, Spence, and then I went to Bryn Mawr and Barnet. By the time I was 20, there was something in me which needed to just burst out of those constraints. And I saw an ad in the New York Times once saying that Motherwell was teaching painting and Ben Shahn drawing and John Cage music and Merce Cunningham dance. And I thought, let's go. and ended up there, and I think it changed my life. It really geared me into being a rebel in terms of literary form as well as a political rebel.
Well, Charles Olson, who you studied with, convinced you that when you wrote, you should really write about what you knew, what you knew best. Mm-hmm. What had you been writing about that made him say that?
Well, I'd taken this lousy little fiction workshop at Barnard in my junior year, in which I was constantly writing because I was hung up on the idea that the only noble writing is fiction. I was writing these horrible short stories about themes or people I never knew, I didn't know anything about. I was constantly in one series stories in my junior year. For example, I was a middle-aged alcoholic actor seeking salvation in a church in the theater district of Manhattan, you know, on 10th Avenue and 46th Street. Now, that's obviously a situation that no 20-year-old woman of my education would know anything about, and they were lousy. And Charles Olson said, stop writing this fictional nonsense and do nothing but keep a journal for 10 years and don't even try to publish anything for 10 years. And I did that. And right at the end of that 10-year period, something happened.
What happened?
I rewrote an autobiographical essay about my childhood, which had gotten me actually the writing prize at Barnard in my graduating year in 52. I rewrote it in 62, 10 years to the date after Olson had told me to not publish, and I sent it to the New Yorker, and they bought it. And that was a piece called The Governess, which turned out still 12 years later to be the first chapter of my first novel, Lovers and Tyrants. So that's the extent of Charles Olson's influence on me. It was very, very vast. It was a kind of paternal censorship, which actually turned out to be a liberation.
Well, I don't know. It seems to me that that kind of discipline is really a mixed blessing. On the one hand, he said, don't publish for 10 years, keep a journal. And you did, and I'm sure it was good discipline to write that journal, and maybe it was a good idea to not publish too soon. On the other hand, that's a very authoritarian thing to tell someone, and surely he can't be that much of a visionary that he knew that it would take 10 years until you had something worth printing.
No, I think that this is really a very paradoxical story, and I think I don't have a copy of my book in front of me, but I think the very last sentence of my essay on Olson expresses that. I talk about the bittersweet irony of being liberated by an authoritarian and imposing male, because these, you know, everything is a gamble, my dear. To rebel against authority is a gamble, and to accept authority can be a gamble, too. Either one can be liberating, and one can be as shackling as the other. Rebellion can be very shackling, too. In this case, paradoxically, I was lucky, and obeying authority, obeying the paternal authority, enriched me. But I'm not saying that it's for everyone, and I think that every time we either obey or disobey, we take a gamble. See what I mean?
Well, I wonder if you think it's been hard for women students to rebel against male teachers.
Well, I think many male teachers are much worse than Olson, because I've heard horror stories about the kind of macho writers who teach short fiction workshops at the new school. They really like to make the women suffer. A lot of them are very sadistic. And I've seen a lot of women come out in tears from those workshops. And yet they are inciting them to write, inciting them to publish. And maybe it would be more charitable to say to the people who are trying to be fiction writers, you're not ready yet. Spend a few years just digging into your own emotions. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that ultimately he may have been on the surface more authoritarian, but in the long run more liberating than all those macho stars at the new school running workshops where women are crying all over the place. So he was for me a fructifying and nourishing presence, but then I did not see him again. You know, we were very geographically separated. I think ultimately you have to have somebody give you a kind of guidance, which often has to be in terms of censorship, and that this could be as creative as false encouragement.
Do you mean censorship, or do you mean just some sense of your limits?
I think sense of the limits is probably right. I use censorship in more of a Freudian way of suppressing certain, for a time being, certain like more Orphic drives to write bad driveling poetry, whatever, and just stick to your guns with keeping the daily journal and just honing your prose that way and doing it in great privacy and perhaps secrecy. And there are many ways out, but I think it's as good a way as any other, you know.
My guest is novelist and journalist Francine Duplessis Gray. A new collection of her essays has just been published. It's titled Adam and Eve and the City. One of the essays in your book is on the trial of Klaus Barbie, the Gestapo chief who was extradited from Latin America to France to stand trial for crimes against humanity. And going back to France brought you back to memories of your childhood and memories with how you fled with your mother from France during World War II. All you say about that was that the experience was terrifying. Can you tell us a little bit more about it? When did you leave France, and what was it like as you were leaving? Was it difficult to get out?
Yeah, it was pretty hard because we left in 1941 in January, and we were under the German occupation for several months in the northern zone in 1940. Then we went to the free zone. And we are very aware that my father had been one of the first heroes of the resistance and that the Germans would not let us get out easily. I guess one of the scariest moments was getting out through the Pyrenees into Spain, because we were in the company of the man who would become my stepfather, who was Jewish, and my mother's companion. And that was really very tricky. They were not letting any Jews out. As you know, they were putting them all in concentration camps. I remember the three of us being smuggled by a cab, whom we had bribed, getting to Madrid, taking the last train that was leaving that month to Portugal, to Lisbon, where we were supposed to take the boat. And I remember the train being so packed that my stepfather-to-be to push my mother and me into the train. My mother refused to get on because it was so unbelievably crowded, and he pushed us on and forced us to get on, and we stood for about 16 hours all the way to Lisbon in the John, hanging on the straps, with a long four of five people in a tiny, tiny space. And I suppose there was so little petrol, so little gasoline that was the last train of the month. And this kind of strikes me as a kind of providential notion. Then the other problem is, of course, is that I was not told that my father had died. And I think, you know, you might ask me a question about that, because that is a very, very difficult problem which comes in when we turn to the suppression of memory and the suppression of mourning and the suppression of grief.
Well, I guess what interests me about your father, among other things, is that you had never really spent any time to investigate his life until a few years ago you went to France for the Klaus Barbie trial. And I wonder why you had waited that long to try to find out more about the circumstances of his death and the last few years of his life.
Well, I think that it could be useful here to use a phrase of Freud's which he calls the work of mourning, M-O-U-R, the work of mourning. It's in a seminal essay called Mourning and Melancholia, which he wrote in the first year of World War I in 1915, and in which he talks about how many people do not dare to undertake the work of mourning, which involves the acceptance of the death of a loved one. And it's real work. You have to go over every detail of the circumstance, shared sites of memory, shared ideas, shared conversations, and test it against reality. No, that person is dead. I simply never dared to do that until my 40s. And so I really only began to do the work of mourning about 25 years after the fact. And I think that, in a way, knowing the exact details of the death, as I did when I had to research the Barbie story, was really kind of completing the work of mourning. I think many of us who lost parents in World War II, especially those of us who lost them to the anonymous mass graves of concentration camps, were deprived of proper grief and mourning because there were no tombs, no graves, no sites. And that's one of the problems that I had with my memory of death. And I think that's why I identify so much also with survivors of the Holocaust.
I'm sure you were also in mourning for your country, which you were forced to leave when you were, what, about 10 years old?
Right.
Now, a lot of people who leave their country leave as political exiles, and they can never go back unless there's a revolution in their country, because they're going to face exile or execution. After the war, you could have gone back. Of course, you were too young to go back independently. But obviously, throughout your adult life, you've decided to return to France only for visits. but never to go back to live.
I went back to live between 54 and 56. Ah. It was a disaster. I got mixed up with a bunch of macho male pigs, if you excuse me, Frenchmen, who were just the most appalling sexists I've ever known. I mean, I think they're worse than anybody in the Mediterranean area. And I was profoundly miserable. And in 56, I came back to New York and married an American and have been fairly steady ever since. But
let's back up here. What was so terrible about these men?
Well, the narcissism and the sort of belated childhood of the average French male in the 50s, at least, as I experienced, and was something quite extraordinary. You know, they're used to living with their moms until the day they marry. And they go on living with their moms until their 30s or their 40s, or this is the way it was still in the 1950s. And they're always at home when they go through university and graduate school and law school, whatever. And they're just very, very spoiled. They want every woman to be both a mistress and a mother and stay very much in the background while keeping their own harem at play. And these are the kind of men I kept running into when I was 24, 5, 6, working in Paris in fashion journalism. And it's not a society that I have ever wanted to live within again. Also, I think very, very petty and stingy and ungenerous compared to American society, but I feel very, very jingoistic about American values of acceptance and generosity and hospitality. I doubt if any other society has it as much as we have, you know. And I've just gotten spoiled.
So you think American men are less sexist than French men, huh?
Oh, I think American men have made great strides in the past decades, very, very great strides. I think it's been hard on the older ones, and I think it's going to be very interesting to know how the work of home is going to be divided the next 10, 20, 30 years, when half the doctors, half the lawyers in the world are women. I think it's going to be a very interesting new kind of society.
My guest is Francine Duplessis-Gray. She's a novelist and a journalist, and a collection of her essays has just been published in a new book called Adam and Eve and the City. And I want to talk with you more about some of the issues raised by these essays, but first we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is writer Francine Duplessis-Gray, who is joining us from the NPR studios in New York. You devote several of your essays to profiling American Catholics who were active as active in the civil disobedience movement against the war in Vietnam. And you say that as a French Catholic in America, you were really struck by the conservatism of Catholicism in America. And I was wondering if you could give a couple of examples of how American Catholics seemed more conservative than French Catholics.
Well, I was brought up by a French Catholic intelligentsia, speaking of my father and my uncles and aunts, whose faith was always deeply tinged with doubt. As one of my uncles used to say, anybody who's dead sure is dead. And they were extremely philosophical about, and almost Zen-like in their approach to faith, that any true faith is always tortured by doubt and tinged with skepticism. And they sent their kids to whatever the best schools were, not to parochial schools, not to church schools. And then I suddenly find myself, when I first written my little book on Catholic radicals, as an example for you of the parochialism of American Catholics, at a church breakfast in which a woman said to me, "How can you consider yourself a Catholic if you don't send your children to parochial school?" So that these are the two great extremes, but I think it is this tendency of the traditional American Irish Catholic community, as I knew it in the 40s and 50s, which contrasted strongly with that more sophisticated more, if you say, cynical, maybe also more jaded, but also deeper kind of faith, which I was acquainted with in France. And I think the answer, obviously, is that the Catholics were a minority in the United States and had to keep very tightly knit, as against a majority in Europe, in the European Catholic nations.
In some ways, it seems that the rationale for the leftist civil disobedience of the 60s has been picked up in the 80s by people who are politically to the right. And I'm thinking that a lot of people who oppose abortion have tried civil disobedience actions to oppose abortion. And even in the Iran-Contra hearings, we've heard about people who thought that they were following a higher motive in breaking the laws. And I wonder if you think that the philosophy of civil disobedience has been picked up by the right during this
time. Oh, I think it's the most striking phenomenon of our time. That, in a way, Arlie North is the right-wing Berrigan of the 80s. That it is, I think they learned a huge amount from left of center civil disobedience of the 1960s and 70s. They learned enormously from the tactics, from the kind of lobbying, the kind of pressuring, the organizational methods of the left, and they are applying it to their own values and purposes. Now, mind you, I think this leads me to an issue which I find is terribly important, which is that I think one of the most important things that the so-called left or so-called liberals can do is to reclaim family values and all the larger values that they represent of being good parents, of taking good care of your children and family compassion and close ties and so on, reclaiming it from the right and reclaiming it from the moral majority, because we are in a phase right now where the moral majority is really claiming to be the only wing of the country, to be strong on family values. And now, this does not have so much to do with civil disobedience, but it will lead to that in the sense that, as we already know, moral majority people and born-agains have bombed and attacked abortion centers, right? So there is a right-wing force doing civil disobedience for their own purposes and ends against what is presently the law of the land. And I think it's just one horrendous instance, and I think it is where we liberals have to come back and reclaim certain mutual territory which we might share with the right wing.
You've written very eloquently over the years about the women's movement and women's issues. And I want to ask you to explain a term which I think you coined. I think you coined the sexual industrial complex.
Yeah.
I like that. Why don't you describe what you mean?
Well, I guess I'm more aware of it than other people because I live in a corner of Connecticut in Litchfield County, which has currently become very fashionable. And within a few miles of me are living... Well, I have to stress that I don't see these people, but I see them, you know, shopping. I see them in their limousines. From a few miles radius, there is Henry Kissinger, Bill Blass, Oscar de la Renta, Dan Furstenberg, and just a dozen of people of that kind who are both in politics and in couture and fashion. And there has been this strange kind of alliance there. I think Nancy Reagan has made a lot of it. I mean, the whole alliance between the right-wing White House politics and the fashion world in the last few years is very evident. And I think, however, the sexual industrial complex is a much larger category than that. Those particular kind of alliances. I see it at work in, for instance, in the pressuring women writers to write more erotically or more pornographically, because there's a certain kind of female porn chic which has been fashionable, was certainly in the 70s. That's one aspect of it. The whole couture industry, which, like this year, is telling us we have to cut our hems or buy 20 new skirts to have to look like tramps in the street. And the whole short hem vogue is another example of the industrial complex at work, which is a complex led by a handful of male tycoons still, and exploits women for financial purposes. And I think that's part of what I mean by this very vast term of the sexual industrial complex.
You were, in a way, brought up in the fashion world. Your stepfather was an editor at Condé Nast Publications, and I believe your mother was involved in the fashion world, too.
She was a hat designer, to be exact, yeah.
And early on in your career, you worked for the French fashion magazine Elle. Was it hard to get out of that and to assert your independence?
Yes, it was very hard because I love my parents, and I think one of the great, great problems that women have towards their mothers when they're growing up is that they want to break with mom and break from the pattern that mom has set. At the same time, they want to retain mom's love. And I think that's another very dominant theme in the parts of my book in which I discuss women's issues, is this very tight mother-daughter bond. I go into that issue at great depth in the recent issue of the Paris Review, in which I have this interview in the Authors at Work, in which I discuss the fact that for years we thought that women were primarily attracted to their father. That was a sort of a Freudian idea. And I think we realized that really they do a lot to please their mothers. And I think in my own case, I was trying to please my mother by following in her footsteps, by trying to be good in her world, which is the fashion world. And I ended up close to a nervous breakdown because I'm not my mother. None of us are our mothers. And we all have to find some ways of retaining our love for our mothers and being able to strike out in totally different paths.
It's ironic in a way that the fashion world was one of the first places for women professionals as writers and
sure.
as designers.
Yes.
But on the other hand, you could make the case that it's also the fashion world that has upheld the traditional values of women's place in society through certain clothes that really describe powerlessness and describe women as beautiful adornments.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I think almost everything that if you see it with any depth is paradoxical. and I think Chanel herself is an extraordinary paradox, that my essay on Chanel in this new book sets out the paradox that here's this woman who really liberated women's bodies like nobody else before, who threw away the corsets and all the constraints, and I was the first one to show women what they were as individuals and not as part of men's chattel and not as a possession of the male. And yet she herself lived a very conventional love life in a state of complete subservience to a lot of moronic, wealthy men. And her fashion, she created an empire, which is part of the sexual industrial complex, which then after her death began to be run by men. So there is always a pro and the con. It's sort of like Olsen's authority. Libertarian action liberating me, Chanel, in many ways a revolutionary, in many ways a conservative woman, still liberating women in many ways. So I think the paradox lies right there.
Well, in a way, you've just brought us back to where we started, to the beginning of your story as a writer, with the paradox of Olsen's advice. And with that, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Terry. Always a pleasure.
My guest has been Francine Duplessis Gray. Her new book, Adam and Eve and the City, is a collection of essays that she's written over the past 18 years. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On our next show, I'll speak with Donald Woods. He was a journalist in South Africa. His anti-apartheid writing and his friendship with slain black activist Stephen Biko forced him to go into exile. A movie about Woods and Biko will be released later this fall. So I hope you can join us. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Coming up, a talk with film director Emile Ardolino. His new movie, Dirty Dancing, continues Ardolino's passion for bringing dance to the screen. His documentary, He Makes Me Feel Like Dancing, won an Academy Award. He's also directed many editions of public television's Dance in America. Also, rock and roll historian Ed Ward looks at the legacy of Cal-Mex rock, a regional sound popularized by Ritchie Valens in the 50s that lives on through bands like Los Lobos. And book critic John Leonard reviews Robert Coover's new novel, Whatever Happened to Gloomy Gus of the Chicago Bears. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. The first album from the rock group Los Lobos, back in 1980, was called Just Another Band from East L.A. The title referred to the neighborhood they grew up in, where Chicano music and rock and roll met. Today, our rock and roll historian Ed Ward is going to explore that music and the real legacy of La Bamba.
Thanks to La Bamba becoming one of this summer's hit movies, the spotlight's back on the Mexican-American contribution to rock and roll. The trouble is, most of the writers I've read build the bridge between Ritchie Valens in 1958 and Los Lobos, who provided the movie's 1987 soundtrack, through Texas. Well, there's certainly a lot to be said about the Tex-Mex sound and its place in rock and roll history, but Ritchie Valens and Los Lobos were coming from somewhere else entirely. That somewhere is Los Angeles, and musically, as well as geographically, L.A. is not Texas. The big difference is rhythm and blues. In the early 50s, when bandleader Johnny Otis bought the Barrel House Club in Watts, he succeeded largely because he touched a chord not only with the Southern blacks who were moving into the neighborhood, but with the Chicanos who were already there. They loved the music they heard at the Barrel House, they loved doo-wops with a passion, and they adopted rock and roll style wholeheartedly. Dances at the El Monte Legion Stadium were legendary rock and roll events and even led to the Penguins of Earth Angel fame recording Memories of El Monte, written by a young man named Frank Zappa. Certainly, Ritchie Valens showed this influence in his work. Donna is a classic doo-wop type of song. Or how about the Heartbreakers, who recorded Cradle Rock in the early 60s? The vibrato-laden voices, the echo chamber, they were all hallmarks of the L.A. rhythm and blues sound. And even after black L.A. started grooving to the sounds of Detroit and Philadelphia, East L.A. was still producing records like Karen by Lil Ray Jimenez.
When I think of Karen, my heart's an open book, for anyone can see that I'm in love with her and that she is in love with me.
Of course, East L.A. kids were still kids, and nice as the slow songs were for close dancing, they still liked to rock. One of the first records to break out of East L.A. into the rest of California was a re-recording of a song co-written by New Orleans legends Chris Kenner and Fats Domino.
You know I feel love.
on the Headhunters version of Land of a Thousand Dances may have been too primitive to go national, but it kept the song alive until Wilson Pickett could have a hit with it in 1966. And then there were the premieres who did make it big. Warner Brothers picked up Farmer John, a version without the girls going nuts, and made it an anthem in the pre-Beatles Louie Louie era. Today, you'll still find a lot of rock and roll in East L.A., not only the music, but also the cars, the clothes, and, on the radio, dedication straight from teenagers' hearts. The music isn't nostalgia either. One of L.A.'s finest punk bands was the Plugs, who are now the Cruzados, and then there are Los Lobos, whose blend of Mexican folk music and down-and-dirty rock and roll make them the stars they deserve to be. Listening to the music East L.A. has made over the last 30 years, you begin to realize that asking the question, what if Ritchie Valens had lived, is moot. His spirit has always been there.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, the Rolling Stone history of rock and roll. He also writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Emil Artolino, director of the new film Dirty Dancing. He spent most of his career bringing dance to the screen. He directed many editions of the PBS Dance in America series, and he won an Academy Award for a dance documentary. Dirty Dancing is set in 1963 at a Catskill Mountain resort. Jennifer Grey plays Baby, a teenager on vacation with her family. Patrick Swayze plays Johnny, the hotel dance instructor. He's paid to teach the guests mambo and cha-cha, but on his off hours he does a different kind of dancing. Baby discovers it when she wanders into a staff party. Emil Artolino described the dancing that left Baby so shocked and excited.
Dirty dancing in the film sort of looks like very close, sensual partner dancing that to rock music of the early 60s, with a lot of hip contact, hip to hip, pelvis to pelvis, and shoulder to shoulder, a lot of sensual body contact.
I'd never heard the term dirty dancing before. Did you?
To tell you the truth, I'd never heard the term dirty dancing before I read this script. But the writer, Eleanor Bergstein, had actually dirty danced in the early 60s in some Brooklyn basements. And I grew up in Queens. We didn't dirty dance, apparently, in the basements of Queens. But it is something, as I got into the film, that I realized did exist and existed in different cities at that time. I met someone from Detroit. He said, oh, yeah, we used to dirty dance. And that's what they called it. And though it never surfaced above ground on something like American Bandstand, it did exist.
Your movie has a PG-13 rating. Did you have to cut any sequences that you filmed in order to get the PG-13 instead of an R?
We did. Yes, we did. But I don't think anything that we cut is missed, frankly. We had to cut a few. The movie was a bit rougher in language. And there was a little bit of nudity in some of the love scenes. But we decided, Vestron decided, that this movie was a movie that a wide audience could enjoy. And for those to adjust those few things to broaden our audience seemed a small thing to do. And we did resubmit it and got our PG-13 rating.
Through movies like Flashdance and through music videos, I think audiences have come to expect a very fast-paced editing style in dance sequences. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of close-ups where instead of seeing a whole body dancing, you see the feet or the head or an right. arm. You didn't take that approach in your movie. You go through for longer periods of time where the camera's on the dancers. You see more of their body. You see full bodies a lot of times.
Well, this sort of fits in with my philosophy about filming dance, whether it's television or film, and that is I always trust the dancing and trust the dancers and believe that the movement is interesting enough to an audience, so you don't have to do that much to it. Now, you know, there are different sequences in the movie that I approach differently. For me, I want the film audience to feel like they're part of the audience, too, and I want them to actually see the dancing. So I favor longer shots and going in for close-ups for that particular emotional moment that I want to emphasize. But I insisted when I first came into the movie that I wanted dancers, actors who could dance. So that I wouldn't be forced to do a lot of intercutting of different body parts a la Flashdance. I mean, I think the producers of that movie had to do that because, the actress and the dancer were two different people.
I've often wondered why the kind of fast-paced, highly edited approach to dance sequences caught on the way it did. And from what you said, I guess that has something to do with the fact that you sometimes have to cover up or compensate for the shortcomings of the dancers.
I think that's true. I think it also is, part of that technique is to sort of bombard the audience with images and sound, music, and the effect of that can be numbing. I think in the case of Dirty Dancing, the dance is tied into the story. All of the dance numbers either move the plot along or reveal character, so that there's an emotional involvement in what's going on if you care about these characters. And I certainly tried to make the audience care. In the videos, which are such short-form type things, you know, it's very hard to build up any kind of rapport or care about the people or the characters in those videos. So you don't have the kind of emotional investment. Plus the fact that, I mean, this movie takes place in 1963, so I didn't want it to feel like it was 1987, even in its cutting style or shooting style.
You mentioned how in Flashdance there was a lot of quick-cut type editing because Jennifer Beals, who played the leading role, didn't do her own dancing. Did you ever use stunts in Dirty Dancing for the mambo sequences, especially for the jumps and lifts?
No doubles for the jumps and lifts. There is one small sequence in the movie where there is a double for Jennifer. And it's a very brief shot. I don't think people realize it. And that's the way I'd like to keep it. I sort of don't want people looking for a double when they go to see the movie. But there was just one sequence that was a little dangerous. And we did have a double come in for very briefly. Patrick did, for the most part, did most of his own stunts, or if you want to call them that.
Now, he had to look on screen as if he was trained in Arthur Murray-type dancing, but in fact, the actor Patrick Swayze was a principal dancer in the Elliot Feld Company. Did you have to work with him in looking like a trained ballroom dancer instead of a trained modern dancer?
You know, a dancer is a dancer, and Patrick's a very good dancer, so he picked it up quickly. But he had to learn the basics of mambo. It's not easy to dance on the two. And they had to learn that and get the style and get the looseness in the hips and the kind of keeping of the frame and the upper body. So yes, he didn't have it when he came into the rehearsal of the movie, but he certainly had it by the time we started shooting.
You've made most of your career in dance. You've shot many of the installments of the PBS Dance in America series. You've done some dance documentaries. You won an Academy Award for one of them. Are you a dancer yourself?
No, I just, when I was in college, I wanted to be an actor, a performer. I did, you know, I studied acting and singing and dancing because I was going to be a triple threat. But I also love to go. As a teenager, I began to go to dance events in New York City. And I, for whatever reason, it just captured my imagination. I liked all those bodies in space, to music. And I was exposed to great choreography at an early age, you know, George Balanchine and Martha Graham, people like that.
When you are directing a dance documentary or a dance film, do you think of yourself as the choreographer of the camera?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I think you have to realize that dance in front of any camera, whether it's a television camera or a film camera, you're dealing with a space that's two-dimensional. With a television screen, it's pretty small. With a movie screen, it can be a lot bigger. But you're always trying to create the illusion of space. And the way you do that is how you frame it. Because every time you make a cut, you're changing the space that the dancer is in. And that affects the audience's feelings. It affects its perception of the moment. There's a kinetic response that you get. So if you are framing and you're moving the camera, all of those things, and depending upon what lens you're using, all of those things affect how the moment is perceived. Then you take all of those shots and you put them together in an editing pattern, which indeed is choreographic in its own right, editing, because it has rhythm, it has duration, it has, you know, many of the qualities of movement itself. It all together combines to create a total effect.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, my pleasure.
Emile Artolino directed the new film Dirty Dancing. This is Fresh Air. You can hear full coverage of today's news on All Things Considered. John Hockenberry, who's co-hosting the program, is joining us from Washington. Hi, John.
Hi, Terry.
What's coming up today?
More attacks and counterattacks in the Persian Gulf. The war seems to be heating up there, and there are a lot of implications for U.S. policy. We'll talk about both of those things. Also, the law that allows Lawrence Walsh, the special prosecutor in the Iran-Contra hearings, to pursue indictments, that law is being challenged. We'll have a look at the legal implications of some of those challenges. And also, a game about an election in Guatemala.
What kind of game and who won it?
Well, it's a game that a bunch of college students from all over the United States played a couple weeks ago here in Washington. The results were inconclusive, but everybody learned a lot about Central America.
Okay, well, thanks, John. Those stories and more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our book critic John Leonard has a review of the new novel by Robert Coover called Whatever Happened to Gloomy Gus of the Chicago Bears. As you may surmise from the title, one of the characters in the book plays football, but his fate is ultimately determined by politics.
Whatever Happened to Gloomy Gus is not a doodle. I say this right away because Robert Coover seems lately to have been doodling in such fictions as Spanking the Maid, Gerald's Party, and A Night at the Movies. Clever little books, but certainly not as compelling as earlier Coover novels, like The Origin of the Brunists, in which a nation evangelized itself to death, or The Universal Baseball Association, in which a crazed accountant played dice with the universe, or The Public Burning, in which the electrocution of the Rosenbergs was explained theologically, or even Prick Songs and Descants, which rewrote Little Red Riding Hood and Joseph and Mary. Gloomy Gus is little and clever, too. But it is also very wicked, and maybe even delicious. It pretends to be the story of a star halfback for the Chicago Bears, whose career comes abruptly to an end in the late 1930s because he can't tell the difference between football and sex. And politics literally kills him. Gloomy Gus is shot to death running a police picket line during the big 1937 strike against Republic Steel. We see Gus through the eyes of Meyer, a left-wing Russian-Jewish intellectual, Chicago style. Meyer, when he isn't feeling bad about the Spanish Civil War, sculpts. He's working on a scrap metal mask of Maxim Gorky. He is surrounded and nagged by Stalinists, Trotskyists, Zionists, anarchists, an angry black novelist, and a hungry black cat. Meyer is mesmerized by Gus because Gus, an absolute materialist, lives only in the present tense, no yesterdays and no tomorrows. Intellectuals like Meyer think of the past and the future as a kind of river, a time stream, but that's just a poetic metaphor. Gus, says Meyer, had no perception of this or any other metaphor. He was completely metaphor-free. He had no imagination at all. Nor is his real name Gus. His real name, revealed late in the game, is Dick. He comes from Whittier, California, where he was known in college as the Fighting Quaker. Does this ring any of your alarm bells? He could have run for Congress instead of daylight, but because he was badly coordinated and had endlessly to practice everything he did, and because there's only so much practice time in life, he had to choose at Whittier between debate and student politics on the one hand, or football and girls on the other. He chose to score, and so programmed himself, beep, beep, until his circuits went haywire and history pulled his plug. Well now, which American president watched football on television instead of anti-war rallies on the streets outside his White House? Which one, just for practice, listened to himself on tape? What if Bibi Rebozo's best friend had chosen to isolate himself from his feelings in the disciplines of other, less dangerous games instead of Vietnam? Sly Mr. Coover has many witty things to say about art, socialism, and sexual dialectics, but he lets Meyer have the last sad word on Gloomy Gus, who is really Tricky Dick. Quote, "Both of us were fulfilling myths about ourselves. His the rags-to-riches drama of the industrious American boy, mine the curse of the wandering Jew. And we were both captives of alienating systems divided within ourselves." Maybe, with a little more love and understanding, we'd all have been happy and whole. Then again, maybe he just should have burned the tapes. Anyway, we're all victims, even Dick Nixon, and that hurts.
Our book critic John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine. He reviewed Robert Coover's Whatever Happened to Gloomy Gus of the Chicago Bears. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time I'll speak with stand-up comic Jerry Seinfeld. He's riding the crest of comedy's resurgence with put-downs of his suburban upbringing. You may have seen him on Carson or on Letterman. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz will review a recording featuring the 94-year-old pianist Mstislav Horzovsky. Horzovsky has a rich musical heritage. His teachers were taught by students of Beethoven and Chopin. And commentator David Mark will defend television against the charge that it brought about the decline in reading. So I hope you can join us. And we'd like to welcome a station new to Fresh Air, KVCR in San Bernardino, California. We thank everyone who helps make Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person. Ed Doherty is the production assistant. Additional help from Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Joyce Lieberman. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. Our theme music is composed and performed by Jackie Byard. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.